you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Terrific to have you with us today. The calm before the storm that's arriving for this weekend. So enjoy it while you can before the rain and potential thunderstorms arrive. We got a jam-packed program a little bit later this hour. Netflix is a Joke, which was an extremely successful comedy festival a couple of years ago, taking over the city's biggest venues. It's back in May, and it's got an all-star lineup. We'll be talking with the founding director of the festival about it. Nick Kroll also be joining us. And coming up next hour on Air Talk, we're going to be heavily involved with television. We'll take a look at some of the best adaptations of international TV series for the American market. And we'll be talking with our TV critics on TV Thursday about the best of new and returning series. But we begin with the arts and the Broad Museum in downtown Los Angeles, which has been a smash success since it opened up with the art collection of Eli and Edie Broad. The Broad announcing yesterday a major expansion so the people can see much more of the tremendous collection put together by the Broads. Joining us is the founding director and president of the Broad, Joanne Heiler. Joanne, good morning.
So happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
I was stunned to see you're getting 900,000 visitors a year. That's amazing.
Yeah, we were really welcoming a huge number of visitors from day one. We knew before we even opened our doors in 2015, we had about 100,000 reservations of people waiting to come on opening day. And that was our first hint that our projections had been all wrong about how many folks would be coming to the Broad.
What was the project, 250,000 a year or something like that?
Around 250. Sometimes we thought, well, maybe we'll do a little better than that as we started to approach opening and saw the interest level. But we've outstripped that number many times over.
And have you benefited at all from LACMA and the construction, the big project there? Do you think that's been helpful?
I think what I'm excited about is seeing so many arts-related institutional projects around LA. You know, Eli and I believe strongly as we made the critical decision to open a museum dedicated to this collection, that there was an appetite in this community, in this region, for more arts and culture institutions. And so it's extremely gratifying to see so many since we opened expand or create new institutions all around the region.
Well, and the Colburn, of course, across the street,
yeah.
Going through its a new Frank Gehry designed expansion.
That's going to be a beautiful extra, a beautiful piece of the puzzle in terms of having a great performing arts venue that's a size that doesn't exist there.
Yeah, you've got, I mean, just so much in the way of the arts, the Music Center, of course, Walt Disney Concert Hall, and Grand Park, so many things that are happening in that corridor. So let's talk about the expansion. It's a 70% increase in the floor space of the Broad.
It's a 70% increase in the gallery space that we have now. And so I think it's important for me to say it is an increase in gallery space, but I want to sort of tease the fact that the gallery spaces in the expansion won't just be more of the same type of gallery spaces that we have in the existing building. There'll be some traditional gallery spaces, and there'll be some other kinds of experiences of the collection throughout the expansion.
What does that mean?
What does that mean? Yes. Well,
it's very cryptic.
So there'll be outdoor spaces on the top floor, which I think will be exciting to see. You know that you arrive on the third floor of the museum, the existing building, and then when you cross the threshold into the expansion, you'll actually enter in an outdoor space rather than an indoor space. So that's just one example.
Mm-hmm.
We have some plans in the works to create experiences that build on the glimpses that people could currently see of the so-called vault. out of the existing building, you know, when you're on the stairwell. But there are just these plate glass windows that give you a glimpse. We know how much our audience has enjoyed seeing behind the scenes in that way. And we're going to expand on that in the second floor of the new building. And then on the ground floor, there'll be room for live programming, and there'll be room for maybe more ambitious media installations. So there'll be a lot of different sort of chapters, is how I'm thinking of it, chapters to a visit to the Broad, rather than more of what you see and experience now in terms of the architecture and the type of art on view.
We're talking with the president and founding director of the Broad, Joanne Heiler, with us. If you have questions about the expansion of the Broad, or you'd just like to share the things that you appreciate most about the museum, it's a good chance to hear from you on that. We're at 866-893-5722. 866-893-5722. You can also comment on our AirTalk page at laist.com/airtalk or email us at atcomments@laist.com. Please include your location and first name. Same architectural firm as built the main museum?
Same architect. You know, it's not unheard of, but it is pretty unusual for an institution to expand in its first decade. So, and given how beautifully the original building has functioned, and given how special it is as an experience architecturally, given how much there's sort of an unfolding experience, which was very intentionally designed by those architects, we really couldn't think of a better situation to have for the expansion than have those same architects take tremendous care in making sure that the expanded Broad will work together. Both buildings will work together beautifully.
Now, Eli, of course, has passed, but what about, is the collection still growing nonetheless?
The collection is still growing. We're extremely fortunate that Eli and Edie, you know, in every sense, founded this institution to be something for perpetuity. Can we use that word still?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. found it really for the long horizon. And as a museum that's dedicated to building a large audience for contemporary art. And so to continue to fulfill that mission, we need to continue to stay active in the conversation with artists and what artists are thinking about as time goes by. And so it is part of the plan that we will continue to collect.
All right. With all the additional exhibition space, will this be largely from the Broad collection? Is that going to be, or is there any other on loan art that'll be part of it?
You know, we have a few years until we open, so some remains to be seen. But the plan at this time is for the majority, if not the entirety, of the new building to be dedicated to the collection, dedicated to the free general admission ticket as well.
And for so much of the collection that you're not able to show, is that just stored in another location? Do you have like a whole other area that has this art just awaiting a chance to be exhibited?
Yeah. Most of the collection is actually on site in that second level vault space that visitors can glimpse through the stairwells in the existing building.
That's big enough to hold the, okay.
Yes. I mean, that particular view is into the paintings racks, right? There are several other rooms that have other types of art and a storage space on the ground floor that also has additional parts of the collection. And I should say also, we lend out art very liberally to other institutions, not just nationally, but internationally, and have done that for decades.
I can't imagine the sort of climate control, fire suppression, all the sorts of things that you have in this museum to protect the collection. It's going to be a very, very complex operation just dealing with the infrastructure.
The infrastructure of an art museum building as a public place, as also a place that cares for these objects that were meant to preserve for decades or perpetuity, if you will, that is a very delicate thing to do and very detailed when it comes to the HVAC, et cetera.
Yeah, I can only imagine. Now, downtown Los Angeles, you know, we've seen since the pandemic a shrinking in the number of people going downtown. It's really been economically hurt. So many restaurants have closed as so many people haven't returned to the office. Are you seeing any of that at all? Or you just seeing people making the Broad a destination regardless?
We are seeing the same attendance levels at the Broad that we saw before the pandemic. We're right at that same level again. And beyond that, in the last 6 or 8 months or so, on a weekly basis, we're seeing growth in our visitorship. So hyper-locally at the Broad, our experience has been that many people from around the region are more than happy to come downtown and interested in coming downtown. But, you know, you put your finger on it, I think, when you said, you know, the office situation, particularly on Bunker Hill, is a big change for the area to sort of metabolize and digest. And but I'm optimistic about the arts institutions.
Let's talk a little bit about the funding for this. So it's $140 million, is that right, for the expansion?
I think you're probably referring to the cost of the original building.
Oh, the original,
and the
I'm
improvements
sure, yeah.
around the original building.
It's $100 million?
Yeah, it's about $100 million for the expansion, which is in line with what institutional buildings of this type tend to cost.
And does that come out of the endowment for the museum, or is that raised independently?
It's funded by the Broad Foundations, so that's all privately funded and essentially internally funded.
Well, I just want to let you know also that LAist is going to be part of the Broad's family weekend workshops with Punk Family Picnic, celebrating the closing day of the exhibit Desire, Knowledge, and Hope with Smog. That's coming up a week from Sunday, April 7th, from 11 to 5. And you can get your tickets for that event. Again, the Broad's family weekend workshops with LAist, Punk Family Picnic, LAist.com/events. Because you do all kinds of events at the museum.
We do all kinds of events, yeah. You know, the collection is at the core, as with any art museum, the collection of the Broad Museum is at the core of what we do and the reason we exist. But to create a really full experience of that collection, bringing into the picture what is happening in performing arts, what's happening in the most progressive music, the most progressive writing, all of that is part of the context in which the artists in the collection work, of course. So we found that to be a great way to connect the collection with lots of different audiences and, of course, lots of different disciplines.
Joanne, with people that collect and support contemporary art, you know, so much of that is getting to know the artists, some of whom are young or mid-stage of their career, and encouraging and doing that. Does the Broad as an institution have a role in that with artists who are currently creating art?
Absolutely. I mean, we've added about 16 artists to the collection in the last 2 years or so. Just last month, we had a terrific conversation with two artists who are very new to the collection, Patrick Martinez and Sarah Gomez, both of whom are based in L.A. We're really focusing quite a bit on the art scene here in L.A., which is just in a very, very interesting moment. And, you know, so that's just one way, having a public conversation with artists, that's one way that we bring their perspectives to life for our audience.
What are some of the things you think are most notable about LA art and what's going on now?
Yeah. You know, I'm seeing there's so many different kinds of art practice in Los Angeles. You can't really boil it down to any one thing. There are a lot of artists studios I've visited recently, artists who are from and working within and working, creating work about the Latinx communities in LA, which themselves are so diverse. And really about I'm just seeing so many kind of artists in that group who are, I think, creating imagery of Los Angeles that hasn't really been done before, and are creating a sort of raising the consciousness of what sort of the real LA is about, what it looks like, what it feels like, and how communities are you know, make their way in this region.
So interesting. We're talking with the founding director and president of the Broad, Joanne Heiler, with us on Air Talk. We're discussing the expansion of its gallery space by 70%, the project breaking ground in 2025, a $100 million expansion at the Broad. And so this is going to be done time for the LA Olympic Games of 28?
It will be.
Very good.
Yeah, we're very excited. And so thrilled to be working with the same architects again, Diller Scofidio Renfro and Liz Diller in particular, who has just such a subtle approach to public spaces that fits our philosophy so well of, of access, of viewing into sort of behind the scenes aspects of museums and kind of breaking down what a museum is, leaving behind what doesn't work and innovating some new things so the experience feels different.
Will the current galleries be able to stay open during construction, or are you going to have to do a partial closure?
We're not anticipating having to close at all. We have to, you know, make a floor slightly smaller while we connect the expansion? I'm sure we will. But full closure isn't anticipated.
That's great. Joanne, thanks so much for coming
Thank
on
you.
Today and talking about it. And exciting times. We'll look forward sometime in 2027 or 28, whenever it is. What's the anticipated completion date?
Before the Olympics.
Before
That's
okay.
all I
well,
can
just
say.
Just leave it loose. All right. Thanks so much.
All right.
Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
Joanne Heiler is the president and founding director of the Broad in downtown Los Angeles. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Coming up, we'll talk about Netflix is a Joke, second edition of the huge comedy festival. Major venues like the Hollywood Bowl and you name it, they're going to be there. And the biggest names in comedy, we'll be talking with Robbie Prah, who's Netflix's head of comedy and creator of the festival, and Nick Kroll, the comedian, actor, and voice actor, well-known for his Netflix hit adult animated show Big Mouth. They'll be doing a live event at The Greek as a part of Netflix is a Joke, the festival. We'll hear more about it when we come back in a minute.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up a little bit later, we'll preview the home opener at Dodgers Stadium. And joining me will be Nick Roman of LAist All Things Considered. It'll be the double play today as A is traveling, but Nick and I will be talking about what we can expect at Dodgers Stadium today, which was actually one of the venues a couple of years ago for the hugely successful Netflix is a Joke comedy festival. Back in 2022, it featured 330 comedians plus, nearly 300 shows at 35 venues. Dodger Stadium, where Gabriela Iglesias sold out two nights, Dave Chappelle broke a record for consecutive sellouts at the Hollywood Bowl, and the festival is back in spring of 2024, in May, for a couple of weeks. And again, at these iconic venues, the lineup includes Jerry Seinfeld, Dave Chappelle, Chris Rock, Ellen DeGeneres, Kevin Hart, Wanda Sykes, Trevor Noah, Bo Burnham, Amy Schumer, Taylor Tomlinson, John Mulaney, Bill Burr, Sarah Silverman. You get the idea. The biggest names in comedy over 2 weeks. And joining us to talk about it is Robbie Prah, Netflix's head of comedy and creator of the Netflix is a Joke Festival. Robbie, thank you for being with us.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for having me.
I'm doing well, thanks. It's quite amazing what 2 years ago you were able to pull off with the lineup, the venues, for the first of these festivals. How did you conceive this as aligning with the comedic mission of Netflix?
Yeah, I mean, we've been doing comedy specials on Netflix for just over 10 years now. And it's such a really important content category for us. Our members really like comedy. And after 10, you know, after almost 10 years of having them watch comedy inside, it was kind of fun to get everybody outside and in cities all around LA. I mean, you mentioned, Dodger Stadium and Hollywood Bowl and The Greek and The Forum and Crypto.com. It's LA has such amazing venues. So many of the world's best comedians live here. So it just made a lot of sense to celebrate where we're at in the world of comedy. and do this huge festival.
Were you concerned going into the first year? I mean, you had the acts, clearly the biggest artists, but concerned about it being in such a condensed period of time, whether you'd be able to get the audience out without within a 2-week period to support all of these acts, even though they were big?
You know, I think we're at a moment right now where, you know, in COVID, lots of folks were sitting, you know, inside their houses, unable to go out to live events. And what we're seeing across live events and comedy and really across the entire industry is folks want to go out and see these performers that they're, you know, deeply, that they deeply love. And, you know, what better thing than to go out and you know, spend some time laughing. So, no, I mean, in fact, we sold way more tickets than we thought last time, than we would last time. And we are going to far exceed that number in our second edition in this May.
Montreal is known for a huge comedy festival. It's a really big deal. How does Netflix as a joke compare to Montreal now?
Oh, I mean, it's a completely different thing. I actually worked at that festival for 12 years, and Montreal was great to discover new talent. So, you know, we have, you know, Nick Kroll coming on. You know, I remember the first time I saw Nick Kroll in Montreal and realized, wow, this guy is clearly going to be a superstar. And now, you know, he's had an amazing special at Netflix, and Big Mouth is one of our, you know, longest running shows. So that festival, huge stars, but also was really about discovery. Mm-hmm. This is just more of a, you know, we're not doing this every year. It's every second year is a real, you know, not to, you know, like an Olympiad of comedy. Pretty much every comedian, you know, in the U.S. Who we've done specials with will be here. So it's a really exciting moment to celebrate all of their success.
We're talking with Robbie Prah, Netflix's head of comedy and creator of Netflix is a Joke, the festival which runs May 1st through the 12th throughout Los Angeles. Also with us, the aforementioned Nick Kroll, comedian, actor, voice actor, created and starred a number of series. The hit adult animated show Big Mouth is also on Netflix, and he will be hosting a Big Mouth live event at the Greek Theater May 2nd at 8 o'clock with a number of prominent guest stars. Nick, thank you for being with us.
Hi, Larry. I'm so happy to be here.
I appreciate it. When you moved to Los Angeles to perform here, you know, what did you find about the comedy scene? What were your thoughts about L.A. as a comedy city?
Well, I'd started doing comedy in New York and moved to L.A. now around 2007. And, you know, it was a different time in comedy. There was a sort of an alternative scene, and then there was sort of a club comedy scene. I remember my dream was to perform at Largo back when it was on Fairfax, and now it's Largo at the Coronet, which has become my sort of home stand-up club in LA. But now, you know, there's the Comedy Store and the Improv and the Laugh Factory, as well as an amazing alternative venues all over the city. But what's been fun is to watch all of those different scenes begin to integrate and create a much larger, cohesive comedy world where that serves so many different audiences, and so many different audiences are finding crossover inside of those different kinds of spaces.
You mentioned alternative comedy. What are some of the hallmarks of that type of humor?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of the people who people would know today come out of that scene, like Zach Galifianakis or Marc Maron or Sarah Silverman, who were performing at other kinds of venues. But because I think of the advent of, frankly, of Netflix and podcasts and all the different social media venues, people have been able to come and find those comedians in different spaces. And now we all are all over the place. You could see Marc Maron any night at the Comedy Store or at an alternative venue on the East Side, and vice versa. And so I think that, and Largo, I think is such an amazing cohesive place to see all types of shows as well.
I'd love to hear from listeners. Love to hear from you, your thoughts about comedy in Los Angeles, some of your favorite places to see it. Maybe you've got some young comedians that you'd like to bring to our attention you think are particularly talented and just coming onto the radar here locally. Share that with us, please, at 866-893-5722. You can share what you've learned about comedy in Los Angeles in the last couple of years or so on our AirTalk page at las.com/airtalk or email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. Nick, how has the success of Netflix comedy specials affected live comedy? What sort of impact? Because so many people see those specials.
Well, I think it can take a comedian who would have in the past, you know, been able to perform at clubs around the country just as a working comedian and really expand their audience. Like someone like Ali Wong, who, you know, before her special was an amazing comedian and was a working comedian, but the exposure that Netflix gave her has made her a household name, and she's obviously gone on to do other kinds of stuff like Beef for Netflix. But someone like Ali or you know, John Mulaney, who I have known forever since college, and those specials really expanded their audience on a scale that has made comedy not just a niche element, stand-up comedy, a niche element of American entertainment, but a central, pivotal venue for entertainment. And I think the Netflix is a Joke Festival is a testament to that. I mean, when I saw the lineup the first time and I see the lineup this time, you're blown away by the as you mentioned, the names that are performing. And it seems impossible that we'll be able to get as many tickets sold. But it happens because people love comedy and also now love the live experience. It's something that you can see someone special and then go see them live. And it just, there's just a different level of excitement to be at a live show and seeing the people you've loved on Netflix then perform and feel the energy in the room.
Well, and there are undoubtedly people who come out multiple times within the 2 weeks because they're fans of so many different comedians. Nick Kroll joining us, talking with us about Netflix is a Joke. The fest is coming up the first 2 weeks of May at more than 35 venues throughout Los Angeles, some of the biggest places, and huge comedians are part of this. And some of them, like your event, Nick, at The Greek, you've got quite a cast. Who's going to be joining you on stage at that great venue?
You know, it's the cast of Big Mouth, my animated show. So Maya Rudolph, who voices the Hormone Monstress, and a number of other characters will be there. John Mulaney and plays Andrew on the show. Jason Mantzoukas, who voices Jay, Richard Kind, Jack McBrayer, Jesse Klein, who voices Jesse on the show, Kristen Wiig, who voices a character I won't mention on the show, and a number of other people who you kind of know and love. Our show will be a little different than just a stand-up show because it's based on our animated show. We'll be doing all types of different things, you know, bits from the show, songs from the show, some surprise elements, surprise guests. And because it's at the Greek Theater, which is one of my favorite venues in Los Angeles, in Griffith Park, it's, you know, obviously it can be a music venue. It's outdoors. The music elements, the sort of bigger theatrical elements that you wouldn't normally see at a stand-up show will be a major, major part of the night.
All right. We're talking about Big Mouth and the live event of Big Mouth at the Greek on May 2nd at 8 o'clock with the cast of the Netflix animated show. Nick Kroll is with us, as is Robbie Praw, Netflix's head of comedy and creator of the Netflix is a Joke Festival. Robbie, will any of these performances be streamed on Netflix?
Yeah, I mean, we have a lot of announcements still to come on that, but we have we're doing a live special, our second live special ever with Cat Williams on May 4th that we're filming out of the festival. So we're pumped about that. And we're also doing the roast of Tom Brady, which we're filming at the festival. So that is something we're really excited about. More announcements to come on that. But you know, this, you know, just take it to, you know, this show that Nick is doing. And the, you know, one of the reasons we're so excited about it, it really is an example of why this festival really works so much with comedy fans. This is a show that I believe there's been, and Nick could correct me, I believe a billion hours between Big Mouth and Nick's other show with us, Human Resources, has been watched on Netflix. And here fans get the opportunity to see those folks live. And this is not a show that you could see anywhere else. This is specific for the Greek that night in LA. They're, you know, huge fans of these shows, and what an opportunity to see it live. Or a show like Tim Robinson, I Think You Should Leave, which is another huge sketch show for us. This is a very rare opportunity to see those folks, you know, in real life. Very excited about that.
Robbie, how do you determine when a comedian is ready for a Netflix special, someone you've not worked with before? Kind of what are the thresholds that tell you as the gatekeeper that someone is ready for this?
You know, I really think, you know, our members are really the gatekeepers. I mean, you have to, we've done so many specials over the last 10 years that we have a fairly good sense at this point of what our audience wants. And we don't expect folks to watch every special we put out. We put out a lot of comedy specials, but really the threshold is this going to be somebody's favorite special? You know, not to keep on putting Nick on the spot, but because he's with us, when he launched a special with us last year, I had so many friends, personal friends, not in the business, saying that that was their favorite special of the year. And when you hear that, you're very conscious as someone on my team that that is something that is, you know, a great pick that, you know, you made for the members.
You also have comedy, and Nick, I'll ask this of you, you know, comedy is so often targeted to specific sectors of the populace. And it's not like, you know, decades ago when someone had to get on network television to be successful or sell comedy albums or things like that and get the broadest possible audience. Now you've got very specifically targeted sorts of humor that's out there. And mm-hmm. you know, as a comedian, describe the ways in which that's moved the art form forward.
Well, I think it's allowed people to speak to their specific experience, and that in turn will speak to a audience that has either a shared experience or an interest in another point of view. What I think is what sets apart certain comedians inside of that is that they speak to their specific experience, but in doing so speak to some universal truths that or a relatability to a broader audience that might not have the same shared experience, but can feel, you know, frustrations about parenting or being unlucky in love or just observations on culture that allow people to engage and relate, even if it's not exactly what their point of view or life is. And I think that's what's so amazing about what Netflix has done, is it's created this platform that has allowed people not only to see the people who they're like, oh my God, that's like what my life is like, to then be like, oh man, that is nothing like my life. Like I don't know if you heard me, but when Robbie said that Cat Williams is doing a live special,
yeah, I heard you.
I was like, oh my God, I hadn't heard that. I was like, I am so excited and intrigued to watch that. Like, that to me is like, I'm just hoping it doesn't drop on the same night as my Big Mouth Live at the Greek, because I'm going to have to bail on Big Mouth Live at the Greek to go watch
to watch Cat
Live.
That's funny.
Just to be clear to your listeners, Nick will be at the Greek
yes.
on May 2nd yes. at the yeah. Netflix is a Jazz Festival. Thank yeah. you.
Yes, fair enough.
Let me ask you about, you know, how the economics of this, Nick, you know, as a working comedian, obviously you're extremely successful, but for people that are starting out and trying to figure out a way to support themselves doing it, how, you know, what are the opportunities for live performance to make any money doing that when you're starting out, or the opportunity to get sponsors for a podcast or YouTube? You know, what's kind of the economics of this like for the performer now?
Well, it's opened up tremendously from where it was. As Robbie mentioned, Montreal was a comedy festival, and there was another one in Aspen when I was starting out. And you really, if you were at my stage or at the beginning of your career, you really needed to go to one of those festivals and get noticed, get signed by agents, managers, hopefully get like some sort of deal to, you know, develop a sitcom, or maybe, you know, once in a blue moon, get like an HBO special or... But that has changed dramatically. I mean, Aspen is no more. Montreal is in real financial trouble. And I think it's because the internet has just opened all of that up so much, so that if you're a funny person and you start to make funny videos on TikTok, or you have a podcast that builds an audience, or you're on Patreon and you have a dedicated group of, you know, people, or you end up doing stuff on NPR, or, you know, you can build audiences in so many ways and build revenue streams for yourself in so many ways, that has changed the economics of it. Or you're a performer live and you are, you know, you can go and make some money doing spots at the Comedy Store, or get paid to go perform at Largo, or get paid to perform at the Dynasty Typewriter, shows on the east side of LA, the Elysian Theater. There's plenty of venues that aren't going to necessarily make you an incredible living, but can help you get out of having a day job so that you can focus on your comedy. But really, the podcast, social media, and eventually, if you really, you know, make a name for yourself, getting a special on Netflix or on some of the other platforms has allowed more and more people to make a living faster as a comedian in different platforms.
It just seems like there's so many ways to find an audience, that connecting the audience with the comedian was such a challenge in the past, and now so many of those barriers removed. Nick, I really appreciate you being with us and talking about your show coming up May 2nd at The Greek, the State of Comedy here in Los Angeles, and the arc of your career. We appreciate it, and we'll look forward to talking with you in the future sometime.
Larry, it's a real pleasure being on your show. I listen to your show. Hearing your voice and speaking directly to you is just tickles me. So thanks for having me on, and thanks for talking about Big Mouth Live at The Greek, and hopefully we can speak soon.
I look forward to it. Nick Kroll, comedian, actor, voice actor, Big Mouth, the hit adult animated show, and that show is May 2nd, the live event at The Greek. We'll continue with Robbie Prah when we come back. He's Netflix's head of comedy, creator of the Netflix Is a Joke Festival, first 2 weeks of May. Now, there's some other aspects of this that we're going to be talking about, including outside joke. And we'll hear about that and more of the performers when we come back in 1 minute. And then it's the double play. LAS All Things Considered host Nick Roman with me will preview today's Dodgers home opener. Next hour on Air Talk, we're going to be talking about the Ankler columnist's piece, about Richard Rushfield, about child labor in Hollywood, and that documentary series about what was happening at Nickelodeon back during the late 90s and early aughts. Right now, we're talking about Netflix Is a Joke, the festival which returns to Los Angeles for 2 weeks. The 2022 festival was a huge hit, and it's back for 2024 at more than 35 venues, the biggest names in comedy. Robbie Prah is Netflix's head of comedy and the creator of the festival. Robbie, tell us about the outside sort of festival within a festival.
The festival's so big that we have a festival within the festival. So thanks, thanks for broaching it. Yeah, outside of the Palladium, we have six nights, three nights each weekend of the festival, running from Friday to Sunday, in which we have these incredible outdoor stages. Every night, a big comedian hosting a show, and you never know what other big comedians could stop in. So, like, for example, we got my friend Bert Kreischer, who's going to be doing a huge show at the Forum and who's listening to us right now, by the way. Hi,
very
Bert.
Good.
And he's going to be doing a big show, and someone like that could drop in and do a show at this show, this festival within a festival. We have Jeff Ross bringing a roast competition. We have
I just don't want to be in his line of sight with Jeff Ross because we get torn out.
No, you definitely don't want to be in there. put you in the first row.
Yeah, right.
But great food, great activations, a lot of fun stuff. So that's really one of the highlights of the festival.
How do you get a ticket for that?
Tickets are available right now, but we also, for $25 all in, very reasonable. But also, if you have a ticket to a show at the festival, you could just show that, at the gate and we'll let you in. This is all about, you could come and see a great comedy show for a really cheap cost, or you could just come and grab a beer before and after a show that you have tickets for. So it's a great little thing. And that's outside of the Palladium, both weekends of the festival.
We'd asked listeners earlier to share some of their favorites of up-and-coming comedians or venues here in Southern California. Allison and Ika Rock said Crystal Adams, a fantastic young comedian. Her album, Ain't I a Wombat, hilarious. Be great to see her on stage at an L.A. festival. She's an L.A. girl. That's Allison in Ika Rock. Robbie, who are some of the younger artists, ones who may be lesser known, that you're particularly excited to see in this kind of a spotlighted festival?
There's so many. I mean, we have over 500 shows over this 12 days. But we have, on the first night of the festival, we have a show called Introducing, which our content team has gone out and scoured the United States for the best young comedians. But I'll tell you somebody that I'm really excited for. Her name is Leslie Liao. And recently, up until January, Leslie worked at Netflix. She worked in the HR department at Netflix while doing comedy on the side. Never met her. Didn't know that we had this, essentially a prodigy inside of Netflix, because she wanted to, make it by herself without speaking to the comedy team. Recently was on a multi-comic show that we launched at the end of last year, and she's going to be doing her own solo show.
That's great. This is like Martha Reeves working as a secretary at Motown,
it's incredible. It's incredible. And so I'm really excited about her. But one of the best parts about a festival like this is, I mentioned Bert Kreischer or Ali Wong or Tom Segura. Oftentimes you go to one of these shows at the festival, and because there's so many artists around, folks are bringing on special guests or their favorite young comedian. So oftentimes you could go to a show to see one of your biggest comedy stars that you love and discover someone else who could become one of your favorite comedians also. So I think, pretty much whatever show you're walking into, there's a good chance for surprises, but there's also a good chance to discover, a comedian that, may be somebody who speaks to you and could become your favorite.
Robbie, thank you for talking with us about the festival. It's Netflix is a Joke Fest, May 1st through the 12th at more than 35 venues in Los Angeles. Thanks so much, Robbie.
Cool. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. Robbie Prah, head of comedy for Netflix and creator of the festival. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Coming up, Nick Roman with me. It's the double play. Aiden not available to join us, but Nick and I will be kicking off the Dodgers home opener, throwing out the first pitch, at least rhetorically. We'll be back in 1 minute.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
The The Dodgers, with a very unusual start to their season. You might recall a few days ago they were in Seoul, South Korea for a two-game series with the San Diego Padres that they split. The Dodgers won the first one, dropped the second one, and those counted in the regular season standings. The Dodgers then came back to Southern California for the traditional freeway series of exhibition games with the Angels, and now it's back to the regular season again for Game 3. It's the home opener. The Dodgers hosting the St. Louis Cardinals. Tyler Glasnow will be on the mound for the Dodgers as he was for their season opener in South Korea. And with me, the host of LAS All Things Considered, Nick Roman. It's the double play. Nick, we're here, the home opener this afternoon, shortly after one.
Yeah, it's a happy day. Boy, this is like the best day of the year, you know, when baseball finally arrives you know, it gives you, certainly during the day, I may sound a little distracted this afternoon when I'm on air because I'll have a bunch of ball games on the TV.
We understand. Very, very exciting day. So let's talk about, I mean, there's so much change with the Dodgers this year. A rebuilt pitching staff, new offensive acquisitions led by Shohei Ohtani. And then we have this bizarre circumstance and multiple allegations involved in Shohei Ohtani and his since fired interpreter.
Yeah, and we'll, you know, the interesting thing will be to see if how well Ohtani can sort of compartmentalize his life and put all of that aside while he still plays baseball. My guess is he can do it, but certainly this story isn't going away. There are a zillion questions still to ask, not just about, you know, the ones that everybody is sort of curious about and speculating. On social media, did Ohtani bet on baseball, though it doesn't look like that, and nobody said that that's the case. But then the other questions are, how do you let somebody who is siphoning off millions of dollars, how do they get so close to you? How does this happen? How is it that, you know, eagle-eyed bank officials or business managers don't notice that all that money is going out the door? You know, and then how do you sort of shake the emotional part of you know, being betrayed in a sense by someone who's been very close to you for the entire time you've been in the United States, to say nothing of adjusting to a new team and a new interpreter and a whole bunch of new pitchers. So, yeah, it's a whole lot of stuff. And, you know, we'll see how emotionally and how mentally strong Shohei Ohtani is in the first, you know, few weeks of the season.
Dave Roberts was asked, I think it was before the first of the Freeway Series games at Dodger Stadium, you know, is this going to be a distraction for the team? I wouldn't think for the team this is an issue because the players don't really know anything. They can't, there's nothing for them to comment on. There's nothing to even ask them about because, so, but for Ohtani, as you're saying, this is really going to be a question with this, with all the unanswered questions out there, is this going to be a distraction to him?
Yeah, and of course, Dave Roberts is a good guy to have in this kind of a situation because he has a Japanese background. He is, you know, he can fend off all kinds of things. He can chat with Ohtani in his own language. There's a lot of good things of having Dave Roberts there. And then the Dodgers are just smart about this kind of stuff, too. Although it would have been nice if they had maybe more closely checked Ipe Mizuhara before, you know, they gave Ohtani a big, big contract. You know, you have to understand who is surrounding the players that you're bringing in. But I would suspect that you're right, that Ohtani and Dave Roberts and the whole team can kind of get past all of this and just play baseball. But certainly the story's not over and something else is going to happen. You know, we will hear more about it. There'll be a development of some sort. We just don't know when it's going to come.
We're talking with Nick Roman. It's the double play in advance of the Dodgers' home opener, their third regular season game of 2024, the game shortly after one this afternoon. I mentioned that Tyler Glasnow was going to be on the mound. He's the ace now of the Dodgers, acquiring him and signing him to a long-term contract, Southern California, young man who played at Ard High School. And then the number two in the rotation, Yoshinobu Yamamoto, all also signed out of Japan, and his debut did not go well in Game 2 in Seoul, Nick.
No, it did not. You know, was that just sort of adjusting to a new team or throwing different pitches or a slightly different baseball? We don't know. We're going to find out. He'll pitch again this weekend against the Cardinals. I mean, I've never seen a guy who had never pitched in the big league who was so highly rated as Yamamoto. And he had done things in Japan that no player had ever done with, you know, what they call the Sawamura Award, which is essentially Japan's equivalent of a Cy Young Award. He won more of those, and he won more MVPs than Ohtani did when he was there. So you would hope that it's just a matter of adjustment. Again, Dave Roberts says that he's not particularly concerned, but Dave Roberts will always say that.
Yeah, right.
You know, nobody's going to say, yeah, especially
really after
worried.
One
I don't
game.
Think this guy's very good. And you got to hope that he's going to be good because he's going to be around with the Dodgers for a long time.
He's only 25 years old. For some reason, I didn't realize because of his distinguished career in Japan, what a young man he still is.
Yeah, and that's a lot of mileage on a kid pitcher. Same with Ohtani. And you know, you hope that they can you have to adjust. It's different in the United States, the way that the pitchers are used and the way that the teams are prepared. Although Yamamoto has a different kind of game prep, the Dodgers have pretty much let him do what it is that he does. But again, adjusting to a new team and a new catcher and a slightly different baseball, it does make a difference.
I'm so excited to see what young Bobby Miller does this season in his early 20s. He may well be the ace in not too long.
I think he'll be the ace by May. You know, I mean, he's
that
good.
He is strong, yeah.
He is really good. He throws really hard. I've been waiting for him to come up for a long time, and he sure looks like that kind of an ace. You know, the other thing, Larry, about it is that the Dodgers have a 5-man rotation. They've got 5 guys sort of in the wings, healing up and getting ready, who can come in the middle of the season.
It's
they have
be
another pitching staff.
We may have a whole other starting rotation of top players. Nick, always a pleasure. We'll talk with you again soon and welcome A back for the triple play soon. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You'll hear him this afternoon. LAist host for All Things Considered, Nick Roman, here on LAist 89.3. I'll tell you what's to come in the second hour of Air Talk momentarily.
How to LA is your connection to Los Angeles. Get to know its history.
The 1920s were a huge boom time in Los Angeles, and downtown was just exploding.
Its politics.
It's the biggest local prosecutor's office in the country.
And its food.
Korean spices with like a hint of sweetness.
And just everything we love about LA. Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. A very good Thursday to you. Coming up later this hour, it's TV Talk with our critics taking us through new and returning series. But we're going to begin the hour by focusing on a streaming documentary series on Max that's been out there for a while now. It's titled Quiet on Set, The Dark Side of Kids TV. It's gotten a tremendous amount of attention. It revolves around performers who were on a number of Nickelodeon's most popular series in the 90s and early aughts. The Anchor's chief columnist, Richard Rushfield, has not only written about Quiet on Set, but he's been writing about this issue of child actors for some time now. Richard, thank you for being with us to talk about the impact of this doc series.
Thanks for having me. Glad to talk about it.
You grew up here in Southern California, as I did. And did you have much exposure to child actors when you were coming up?
Well, I actually had I went to Crossroads School in Santa Monica, and Gary Coleman at sort of the end of his Different Strokes run joined our class, and I got to know him slightly and see his story up close, and was. You know, I was young and I didn't understand everything that was going on, but there was this real sense of tragedy around him that stayed with me all these years.
Yeah. And what's been the reaction of the industry to Quiet on Set and the allegations that have been central to it of a highly abusive environment, very specific acts of abuse of child actors? What how's the industry responding?
You know, it's getting more attention than anything on this topic has gotten in a long time. It's since I've been writing about it for about 10 years now. It's a topic that Hollywood very much does not want to talk about in any way. And now they are sort of doing what they do when there's a scandal, which is co-stars tweet their regrets. Everybody says they're sorry. And official Hollywood keeps its head down and waits for this to pass.
You know, there've been articles written about this, and this, you know, may have been the focus of some of the work you've done, but about kind of this whole machine of the parents who bring their kids in for the pilot season and get the, you know, short-term stay apartment, and the kids get a lot of pressure. They're the meal ticket for the family, sort of, you know. And again, that's not all the cases of child actors, but something that's frequently seen. How can that be fixed? Is there a way, when parents are often the ones who are putting their kids into harm's way, is there a way of the industry can protect those kids more?
Yeah, it's a terrifying thing, because we've heard lots of terrible horror stories of child stars and the awful impact that being involved in entertainment and being sent to work for a living at a very young age has on their life. But the stories we hear are just kind of, they're almost lucky. I don't want to say people that are abused are lucky, but they are the ones that broke through. And for every one of those, there's 100 that come out here and are trying to break it in and get it in and being taken on the rounds of auditions and headshots. And there's this entire industry of agents and managers and stylists and everything to preying on these parents who are come out here and are very desperate to have their children break into the industry. And that is entirely unsupervised, unregulated. The industry itself has nothing to do with it until they're admitted to SAG. SAG is not involved, and it's the industry needs to take responsibility for this sort of satellite world that it's created around itself.
We're talking with Richard Rushfield, chief columnist with The Ankler. And of course, Thursdays, we have an opportunity to talk with many of The Ankler's terrific journalists about a variety of topics in the Hollywood entertainment industry. Today, I'd be very interested in hearing from you, if you're an Air Talk listener who was a child actor. Maybe you're a child actor now. You'd like to share what your experiences are like. But if you're someone who went through that process of trying to break through as a child actor, and maybe you're someone who did get cast in one or more roles, what that experience was like for you. What were the pros and cons of that experience? We're at 866-893-5722. 866-893-5722. You can also email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name, or you can comment on our show page at las.com/airtalk. Richard, for those who actually do get cast, who have that level of success, what is the set like for a child actor?
It's not. There are some level of protections. There are limits to the number of hours they could work. There are on-set tutors. In theory, there's supervision, but there's not nearly enough. And it's too much of it is devoted to making this a regular thing for children, and not recognizing that having children working for a living and having careers on your set at the youngest of ages, at babies even, is an extraordinary thing, and we need to have extraordinary protections for it, not just sort of regular setting the parameters of the workday, but the you know, a Hollywood set is not a place that people would generally call a family atmosphere, where you where yeah. most people would want their kids just hanging around. And there's not nearly enough measures taken to change that in the cases where you have children spending their lives there, essentially.
And I wonder too about when you've got kids that are in series or films, wherever, where there are multiple kids and the level of competitiveness. Now, in some cases, there may be deep camaraderie. We hear these stories of people who worked on the same show and became lifelong friends, and that was really fostered beginning with their working together. Other times, we hear about great rancor, competitiveness, a lot of pressures the parents sometimes put on these child performers, and then that gets acted out by the kids and competitive behavior with the other kids on set. And you mentioned about their needs to be a tutor or a teacher that's on set. I wonder about having psychotherapy available for kids to work through some of these things.
Yeah, you start with the pressure of, there are extraordinary cases where you have a child that just has a natural talent and is driven, and this is really what they want to do. And, you know, I think that can, to some extent, that can be too often. This becomes about a child supporting the family or living out their parents' dreams or their acquiring fame that their entire retinue can bask in. And those are really unhealthy incentives for unhealthy requirements for a child to have to carry, for people, you know, for a 10-year-old to be thinking about, if I blow this scene, my family is not going to be able to eat tonight or pay their rent or anything. It is terrible pressures, and too little of the money is set aside for their future, and too much goes to sort of supporting what becomes often an adventure for the whole family.
And one of the things I think is unfortunate, at least I'm not aware of any sort of studies of this. We get memoirs, we get personal accounts, we get the, you know, terrible stories that have been told on Quiet on Set, The Dark Side of Kids TV, which are just, you know, heart-wrenching stories. But Richard, I'm not aware of any sort of systematic look at what the longer term impacts are, looking at a large group of child actors. Are you?
No, it's really, really hard to find anything resembling data or studies or looks at it. You would think that if an industry decides, well, we're going to use a lot of child labor, they would take a close look at how that works out and how that goes and what are things they can be doing better. But you can dig really hard to try to find a study on this, and you don't, and all we're left with is sort of the memoirs of former child stars, which tend to be almost universally negative, and to the point of horror stories are kind of the norm.
Again, I'd love to hear from any Air Talk listeners, if you were a child actor, are one currently, are the parent of a child actor, and you'd like to weigh in on this, and to what extent you think the industry protects and helps child actors go through what's a very challenging profession early in life. We're at 866-893-5722. Rima in Santa Monica, I understand your daughter is an actress. Thank you for being with us. What's your daughter's experience?
Hi, Larry. My daughter, Ramea, has been an actress since she was 9. And I wanted to say that SAG-AFTRA has a fantastic youth program. They meet once a month, and there's a parent and child, like, social time at the beginning. And then they break the kids off into age-appropriate groups, and they go off for a couple of hours and do activities. They get educated on, you know, the industry, and then the parents have their own education class. And the people who run it are just fantastic. They've been there for years and years, and it is their mission in life to serve the children in the industry.
That's
when they're
great.
In SAG-AFTRA. And she it's like a youth group that meets once a month, and it was just fantastic. It made her experience in the industry really good.
Well, and it's got to be hard when you said, I think you said your daughter started at 9, because unless you're experiencing what she did as a professional, you know, other kids your age aren't going to be able to relate to that. Rima, is that part of what this group offers?
Yes, and so she had a lot of, she made a lot of friends in the industry as well who were in, you know, around her age group. And so that made things all that much better. And when you're young, you know, and you're a young child, the industry is nicer to you, right? Because you're a young child. But as you grow into your teens, it becomes not as nice and kind to you. So that was a very important touchstone for my daughter to have. And I really, really, really appreciate SAG-AFTRA and their youth program.
Rima, what about, you mentioned that they have this education program for parents as well. What are some of the things that they help parents like yourself with?
Correct. So they have, so when the kids are off doing their activities, they would educate us on investing the children's money, different schools, different programs. They had field trips for the kids, safety protocols, just how SAG-AFTRA works, for how to navigate SAG-AFTRA for the parents, in the best interest for the children. Just fantastic. And she's not a full paid member yet. So you can be SAG-AFTRA, what is it, eligible. So we started her membership. I'm still paying off to get her a complete membership. And once you're a full member, then you have voting rights. But as long as you're SAG-AFTRA eligible, you can join the youth group.
Rima, thank you so much. I really appreciate you sharing that experience with us. We also have Robert with us. Robert played the father on the long-running series Lizzie McGuire. Thank you so much. Robert Carradine, is it?
Yeah, that's me, Larry. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for being with us. So what was it like for you working on that series with child actors?
Well, as I was talking to the lady that answered the phone, it's kind of, my experience was the opposite of the basic angle that your show has been touting today. We had a completely harmonious set. We had the child teacher, the kids had regular hours where they had to have so many hours a day in school. Their hours of work were limited. The meals were regulated in terms of timing. And like I just said, it was very harmonious. It was a wonderful set.
I'm just curious, years later, if you kept in touch with Hilary Duff and Adam Lamberg, any of the other folks on that series?
Oh, yeah. I'm still in touch with Lelaine, and I'm still in touch with Jake Thomas.
And did they share that they experienced it as you do, very harmonious, very positive set?
Absolutely, yes. And we were all sad to see it go because we were kind of our own little family. And our shared enemy tended to be the directors who came in. So we would gang up on the directors and make sure that they ran the show the way we wanted it run.
And for the showrunner who ran Lizzie McGuire, or if you had multiple showrunners, did what are the ways that you felt like they created a set that was a better experience for the child actors?
I think because they treated these kids a bit like young adults, and they listened to things that they might have comments on, and it was not a us versus them environment. It was all inclusive. Everybody was in the same boat.
Robert, thank you so much. I appreciate you joining us and talking about it. He played the father on Lizzie McGuire's 65-episode series that ran in the early aughts. Let me go back to Richard Rushfield, chief columnist with The Ankler. Richard, your thoughts about our two callers, the mother of a performer and an adult performer who worked with kids.
You know, when people have good experiences and there's a set that functions well and the children are looked after, I'm very thankful for that. And I know that at SAG, there's a lot of people that that really try to make an effort to make this a safe environment. The bottom line here is that the entertainment industry is the only industry in the developed world that relies on hot child labor, and we rely on it a lot. And that is an extraordinary thing. And it's not enough to say, well, a few of these people have had good experiences and they have some good people working. Like that, if we are going to do that, we have to recognize it's an extraordinary situation, and the protections on children have to be extraordinary. And when revelations come out, like Quiet on the Set, that should be a disaster that the entire industry responds to and looks at how do we make sure this never happens. Hollywood sets are places where the stars have enormous entitlement and privilege to treat anyone around them any way they want, and the producers and directors do too. They are incredibly hierarchical, and if you are, say, a child at the bottom of that, it's a really vulnerable place to be. And part of the what I recommend is, I think everybody who comes into contact with children on sets should get training and certification that they know how to deal with children, and they should make sure that they do that. And there's nothing like that right now.
Richard, thank you so much for talking with us, not just about your latest column on this topic in the wake of Quiet on Set, The Dark Side of Kids TV, but the writing that you've been doing close to a decade on this subject. We appreciate it very much.
Thanks for having me and talking about this topic.
Thanks, Chief Columnist with The Ankler, with whom we're in partnership on these Entertainment Thursdays on Air Talk. Richard Rushfield with us. Coming up, we continue on the theme of entertainment with the best adaptations of foreign TV shows to American series. We'll talk about which ones held up best when they went from the international market to the U.S. That's all coming up when we return in 1 minute. Hit me. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Let's talk about some of the best TV shows that are adaptations of series that were developed in other countries. There's so many of them that have come from elsewhere, sometimes even better series in the U.S. All in the Family, a prime example of that, was adapted from sort of a middling British series and became a hit U.S. series. The Office, of course, one that was a huge smash in the U.K. and then very popular here in the U.S. In this clip of the U.S. version, the workers at Dunder Mifflin Paper Company talk about CPR training.
All right.
So, assessing the situation, are they breathing?
No, Rose. They are not breathing. And they have no arms or legs.
No, that's not part of it.
Where are they? You know what? If we come across somebody with no arms or legs, do we bother resuscitating them? I mean, what kind of quality of life do we have there?
I would want to live with no legs.
How about no arms? No arms or legs is basically how you exist right now, Kevin. You don't do anything.
All right, well, let's get back to it, because you're losing them. Okay, too fast. Everyone, we need to pump at a pace of 100 beats per minute.
Oh, okay. That's hard to keep track. How many is that per hour?
How's that going to help you?
I will divide and then count to it.
Right.
From The Office, CPR Training, one of the series that translated quite well from the UK to the US. Joining us is LAist film critic and international TV and film expert Wade Major. Wade, thank you for joining us. Talk about the best adaptations to American series.
It is my pleasure. It is a fascinating subject, because people don't often realize just how fluid the television market is globally.
Yeah, and there, we see this not just in scripted programs, but reality, like Antiques Roadshow on PBS. That started as a British show.
And Survivor started, I believe, in the Netherlands. Dog Eat Dog, I mean, you know, Big Brother, all of these things they started overseas because they didn't have the budget to compete with American shows, which were highly budgeted scripted shows. So they went with more affordable game shows and reality shows. And then when, you know, we needed to be able to make things more affordably here, we went and borrowed those back. So it's really a fascinating symbiosis.
Well, I'd love to hear from listeners. What's your favorite American series that is based on or adapted from one abroad? We're at 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722. You can also email us at atcomments@las.com. Did you know, for example, that the network series The Good Doctor is based on a South Korean series, Good Doctor? Wade, did you know that?
I did know that, and what's even funnier is how many shows are now being exported back to South Korea, like Suits, and it's fascinating. You know, we borrow some of theirs, they borrow some of ours, so it's a two-way street. I tend to think of it sometimes in film terms, too, you know, that Akira Kurosawa remade an Ed McBain novel, so Asia and Hollywood have an... Great film. So Asia and Hollywood have a great two-way street on all of these things.
So true. From Japan, of course, Iron Chef became Iron Chef America, and it was the Japanese version which actually became a hit on Food Network, and then they decided to use U.S.-based chefs for Iron Chef America. Jane the Virgin was a Venezuelan show, Wade.
Yes, and Ugly Betty was a Colombian show. So, you know, it's global. It's from Europe. It's from South America. It's from Asia. It goes all over the place. And, you know, my favorites are, all, of course, all those great sitcoms from the 70s and All in the Family, Too Close for Comfort, Steptoe and Son, which became Sanford and Son. You know, those Three's Company was Man About the House in the UK originally. So a lot of great sitcoms from the 70s originated in the UK.
It's funny, Israel, a small country, but it's had a pretty significant TV influence here. Homeland was Prisoners of War in Israel.
Yeah.
Hostages under the same title in Israel. And In Treatment, that series that was based around therapy sessions, also from Israel.
It's interesting that all of this kind of began when they were able to make higher budgeted shows overseas. Once they, you know, they used to try to compete with Hollywood, they couldn't compete with Hollywood, so they would make the reality shows. But then once their budgets increased, they began to make their own shows. And we've seen that, you know, MHC Networks airs some very high quality foreign shows. And a lot of them are just coming back here now because Hollywood is realizing these are great ideas. They've been vetted. The scripts have been proven. They have audiences. So it's much easier to sell something that's already market tested.
Well, let's hear another example. This from a reality series. I use that term very loosely. A clip from Love Island USA as contestants introduced themselves for season 5. This came out last year. The dating reality show originated way back in 2005 in the UK, and it's evolved into a number of different international versions, including Love Island USA.
Guess what? I'm your microbiologist.
Under all of this, it's a lot of brains. So if I'm giving all this,
I want you to look good. I want you to smell good. I want your smile good. I want it all.
I am freaking fired up for Love Island. 6'3", solid steel and sex appeal is not something you want to walk by. Megan Margot is a very pretty sight.
Hi, my name is Anna. I'm going to become a detective. But I actually already am. If a guy asks me out, I will find out his address. I will find out his parents' name. I am a little bit of a stalker, yeah.
That from Love Island USA. We're talking with our Film Week critic, Wade Major, who is an authority on international television and adaptations to English series. I'd love to hear from you. If there's a particular one that stands out to you, we're at 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722. You can also email us at las.com, or put that on the page at las.com/airtalk, or email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. House of Cards is one that came from elsewhere. Fear Factor, so many different shows. Yeah. Are you there, Wade?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes,
sorry, I've got a little background noise.
Yes. No, it's it's what's always been amazing to me are the countries that respond to certain shows from here. The fact that, you know, 24, great concept, that was adapted in India, which you know, who would have thought that India would respond to 24 as opposed to something like the UK or even Israel? But, you know, you just never know. You never know where a great idea is going to take root.
All right, 866-893-5722, or you can email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. Let's see, we have some listener comments that are coming in. Anne-Marie and Whittier said, In Treatment was fantastic. I wish there were more than three seasons. We were mentioning that that was a show that originated in Israel. 866-893-5722, or you can email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. Wait, one of the things that we see, of course, is for some of these series, I think The Voice is an example. It seems like there are almost dozens of versions. Go to every country that has its own television networks, and you've got a version of some of these reality shows.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, like American Idol may be the best example, and The Voice is a good one too, because it's easy, because every country has singers. Every country has talented people who want to become famous. I think American Idol has at least a dozen versions around the world. So, you know, if it's something that's adaptable to many different cultures, and that certainly is, and The Voice certainly is, then, you know, open season. And that's not an expensive show to produce.
Let's talk with Grace in Culver City. You're on Air Talk. Grace, what's one of your favorites of a series adapted for the U.S. market?
Actually, both the British version and the English or American version both stream on Paramount Plus. So I love watching both of them because the British humor is really dry and then the American version is just hilarious. The show is called Ghost.
Yeah.
And then the British version is Ghost UK, and both of them happen to stream on Paramount Plus. So I love both of them.
I saw the British one. I think I saw the first three seasons of Ghost, the UK version, and enjoyed it very much. And so, you know, when CBS picked it up and did a U.S. version, I was kind of wondering, well, you know, what's going to... And I liked the U.S. version better. I actually thought it was a stronger cast and a funnier series doing it as the U.S. one. And I was surprised because I was I was surprised that, you know, that they would do that. So sometimes the adaptation is better than the original. Grace, I appreciate it very much. Hugh in Culver City also mentioning Ghosts, originally a UK show that got so popular that the original UK show ended up on CBS during the strike. Yeah, that's right, when they couldn't do the new episodes of the American version of Ghosts, they started showing the UK version to introduce that to American viewers as well. 866-893-5722. Nick in Santa Monica says, my favorite is the FX show Wilfred, about a man who can see his dog talk in the form of a man in a dog costume. It was originally an Australian show, and the creator of the show played the dog in both the original and the remake. Wilfred, a show on FX. Nick, thank you very much. Wade, did you ever see Wilfred?
I never saw Wilfred, but it's interesting. That reminds me, you know, sometimes we don't talk often enough about the ones that don't necessarily work. And one that I always thought was curious was Coupling, which was a great UK sitcom, the kind of a more risque version of Friends. And they adapted it here with the identical scripts. Didn't really work. Americans didn't respond. And it, you know, was it casting? Was it just a different culture? No way to know.
Yeah. Wade, thank you so much. Appreciate you talking with us about this, looking at series adapted from elsewhere for the U.S. market. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Coming up, we'll talk with our TV critics for the week, Angie Hahn of The Hollywood Reporter and Kristen Baldwin of Entertainment Weekly. We'll hear about the Disney Plus streaming X-Men 97, Max's The Jared Carmichael Reality Show, and Hulu's We Were the Lucky Ones. Those and more series coming up in 90 seconds.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of the How to LA podcast. How about we go to the movies? Join us for a 10-part series, Revival House, and discover the magic of LA's indie theaters. Who knows? You might meet someone.
I know it sounds antithetical because you're just sitting passively, but in fact, you're connecting with everyone else around you.
Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's Air Talk and time for TV Talk, which we bring you every Thursday. Joining me are critics Kristen Baldwin of Entertainment Weekly and Angie Hahn of The Hollywood Reporter. And as that music suggests, we begin with X-Men, the new Disney Plus animated series X-Men 97. Angie, what do you think of it?
Oh my gosh. So I'm exactly the right age where when I hear that theme song, I just immediately get giddy. So I was probably in some ways already primed to like this show because it's X-Men 97 is a continuation of X-Men, the animated series, which ran on Fox in the 90s, which is when I was a kid. But, you know, as we've seen with a lot of like reboots and revivals and sequels, just because it's something that you used to like that's come back doesn't be successful in the new version. And I'm really happy to say that this one actually does. Let me reassure you, you do not need to remember plot points from 30 years ago to understand this one. It does kind of pick up where that story left off, but it's enough has kind of shifted, I guess, in the interim that it feels like you're starting a new story and not just being dropped into the middle of one that's been going on. And you know, making a superhero series that feels fresh in 2024 seems like it's probably really hard to do considering how many superhero shows and movies we've had since the original went off air. Like, I think was an X-Men series alone, but this one I read them, I feel so retro, it kind of comes back to feeling new and exciting and fresh again. Like, it's a little bit more polished than the old one was. It comes back to that same visual style, which in this day and age makes it stand out. It actually managed to avoid the trap that so many of these reboot sequel type shows fall into of getting too nostalgic or like too self-referential or like too self-conscious about like, hey, remember this. Instead, it just kind of gets on with it. Like, it's, you know, it's got the big superhero action. It's got lots of, you know, the usual X-Men metaphors about socially oppressed classes and saving the world and all that. But it's really also at its heart a soap opera, which is the thing that is delightful. You know, there's love triangles and a pregnancy and like a dramatic will and testament reading and all that. And then because they're the X-Men, there's also time travel and, you know, like evil psychic villains and an evil doppelganger and all. Just, it's so juicy, it's so fun, it's kind of silly but also kind of serious, and it's all wrapped up in a little half hour package. So what's not to like?
Sounds like fun. We're talking about the animated series X-Men 97. It's on Disney Plus and family friendly with a TVPG rating. The Jared Carmichael reality show is streaming on Max and airing on HBO Network. It's a reality series featuring the actor-comedian. Kristen, what do you think of the Jared Carmichael reality show?
Well, I really didn't know what to expect from it, you know, especially because the title, we've sort of been conditioned to view the term reality show with skepticism, you know, often code for contrived and curated drama. But it turns out that this title is really ironic when it comes to the show, because this is a very audacious peek into the life of Jared Carmichael, the 36-year-old comedian who won an Emmy for his special Rothaniel in 2022, where he came out as gay. And this docuseries offers a very frank and at times quite unflattering portrait of him as he strives to, quote, live more truthfully as a friend, a partner, a son, and an out gay man. And it's really fascinating because he says the cameras hold him accountable. Meanwhile, we see him do things like, you know, completely let down his best friend on his wedding day, cheat on his boyfriend, you know, things that are really real and yet, you know, not at all contrived and flattering for him. But it also has some really emotional and wrenching themes about his parents who rejected him, his their reaction when he came out as gay was very negative. And he goes through a long period throughout the 8 episodes where he's, you know, really confronting them about it, talking to them. And it's very emotional. In addition to the show, you just can't believe, why would you let cameras, while you're doing this? But then there are these other moments that are just, you really feel for him. So it's a really fascinating use of reality TV.
And I was wondering, would this be like a Curb Your Enthusiasm sort of thing, mm-hmm. where it's unflattering, but it's all designed for comedic effect? It sounds like here, this is really attempting to show his life.
Yeah, no, there's no, you know, he's not playing a version of himself. He is himself on this, and his, you know, his parents, his boyfriend, his, you know, we see them in couples therapy together. There is no area of his life, including where he's really, you know, his behavior is quite, you know, embarrassing in terms of like, he should be ashamed, and he is ashamed. And he really more than once sort of reiterates how he feels like the cameras are going to help him be accountable and change.
We're talking about the Jared Carmichael reality show. It's streaming on Max, premiering tomorrow with the first episode on HBO Network as well. There'll be a total of 8 episodes. We Were the Lucky Ones is streaming on Hulu. It's set in the immediate aftermath of World War II with a Jewish family reuniting. The first 3 episodes of the series are premiering today. There'll be a total of 8 of We Were the Lucky Ones. Angie?
This one actually spans World War II. It follows this Polish-Jewish family known as the Kurtzes, who are based on the real family of Georgia Hunter, who wrote the book that the series is based on, and it kind of tracks their journeys from 1938 to 1945. And as you can imagine, things get really harrowing and dark and dramatic and sad. Like, before the story even kicks in, we get a caption informing us that like 90% of Poland's Jews were annihilated during World War II. So in that time, these characters, who consist of 2 aging parents and 5 adult children, are spread kind of all over the world, like, you know, trying to flee, going off the war, getting imprisoned, trying to find each other, which is a lot of ground to cover in 8 episodes, which means the story moves pretty fast and, you know, kind of is forced to prioritize efficiency over nuance, which sometimes comes at the expense of the characters, who I thought were drawn a little bit broadly. But I do appreciate that it tries to make room when it can for these really small, for these smaller, really humanizing moments with these characters, and that through them you get to see how something like this feels lived through, you know, because I think from our perspective, it's something that's already in the past, but when you're connecting with these characters, it feels like, oh, okay, like, I see how every time they think they've hit rock bottom, it just continues to get worse. And yet at the time, it has this core of, you know, this really strong, warm familial bond. So there's always something, a kind of ray of hope bringing you through even as it gets really dark. So I didn't think it was perfect, but I thought it was really fascinating and ultimately really moving.
We Were the Lucky Ones, streaming on Hulu starting today. Kristen?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, I went in, you know, bracing myself, like, it's never easy to press play on anything about the Holocaust. But I agree with Angie in that, you know, there, it definitely rewards you with some ugly cry uplift. And I did really enjoy the cast. Joey King, who was Emmy nominated for The Act, I think will get another Emmy nomination for her role as Helena Kirk, she's one of the daughters and just a very fierce advocate who goes through a lot of hell like most of her family. But I just thought she was great. And Logan Lerman, you know, the heartthrob with the adorable boyish face, is also very sweet and suave as her brother Addie.
We're talking about We Were the Lucky Ones, first 3 episodes premiering today on Hulu. There will be a total of 8 episodes. It's rated TVMA. When we come back, we'll hear about the BET Plus series Diara from Detroit, starring Diara Kilpatrick. And we'll also hear about Homicide New York, a 5-part documentary series on Netflix. You're listening to Air Talk on LA, it's 89.3. It's TV Talk Thursday. We'll be back with critics Angie Hahn and Kristen Baldwin in just a minute. We're joined by television critics Kristen Baldwin of Entertainment Weekly and Angie Hahn of The Hollywood Reporter. It's a reminder coming up in a few minutes from NPR. It's Here and Now. Tomorrow I'll be with you on Film Week at 10 o'clock. Our critics talking about all the new movies of the week. And we'll also be talking about a new biography of the great director and writer Billy Wilder. That's tomorrow at 10 o'clock on Film Week. And Julia Paskin will be hosting in my and Austin Cross's stead tomorrow. She'll be hosting the 9 o'clock hour of Air Talk. We continue with television series looking at Diara from Detroit. It's streaming on BET+. It's an 8-episode series starring Diara Kilpatrick. Angie.
Oh, this one is really fun. And what I liked about it is that it's a totally unhinged premise that starts in a weirdly relatable place. So at the center is Diara, played by Diara Kilpatrick, who's having a really hard time. She's going through a divorce and feels really lonely and heartbroken and humiliated. So when she finally has a really good Tinder date, it feels like things are finally turning up for her. But then when the guy stands her up for their second date, she becomes absolutely convinced that something horrible has happened to him and she needs to investigate, even as all of her friends are like, no, he probably just ghosted you. Of course, in her case, she's right, because otherwise it wouldn't really be much of a show. And her investigation brings her into contact with these dangerous mobsters and becomes connected to this missing child case from decades ago. And it just kind of gets more and more out of control from there. So it's part midlife crisis divorce comedy, part crime drama mystery. Kilpatrick does a lot of voiceover in the show where you're in this character's head and like in her thoughts, and it's sort of, you know, half overheated spooky noir stuff and half kind of stand-up-ish observational humor. It's instinctive. It feels very much like the product of her own unique voice, and it leans more funny than dark, but I do think it takes really earnestly, you know, how Diara feels about what she's going through and how hard it is to scrape yourself back together after something like a divorce and, you know, trying to get back in touch with yourself and find a new direction forward. So I don't know. I had a lot of fun with this one. I like that it's this shopping tone. I like that it's, kind of playful, but also clear at the same time. I think it's a really intriguing premise and has a really fresh comic voice. And I just recommend it to anyone who wants to have fun.
All right, Diara from Detroit on BET+. Half of the 8 episodes are out already. Homicide New York is from Dick Wolf, of course, who created so much scripted television over decades for NBC. This is a Netflix streaming 5-part documentary series looking at a number of homicide cases in New York. All 5 episodes are streaming and a great success for Netflix. They've attracted large numbers of streamings. Kristen, what did you think of Homicide New York?
I really liked it. I mean, I certainly, I'm not a Law and Order person. I can appreciate what Law and Order is, but, you know, I'm also, you know, I lived in New York for a long time. So I just thought I'm gonna try this. And what I like about it is, you know, first of all, everything about it is very New York, from how the detectives talk to the crime scenes, because this, you know, the crimes take place in places like the Carnegie Deli, Central Park, the Financial District, all these sort of landmark places. And the show follows a sort of loose Law and Order template where you first part, you know, they chronicle the crime and the investigation, and then the second part follows the prosecution of the accused. But what I like the most about it is that, you know, Dick Wolf has a real eye for intriguing characters. And in part, I think he chose these cases because the men and women who solved and prosecuted them are really great storytellers. They're interesting people, and he presents them in a way where you see them as human beings, you know, people who have insecurities and idiosyncrasies and regrets. They're not just sort of the talking heads that you're used to seeing on some true crime. And I will say, you know, historical spoiler alert, all of these cases end with the killers behind bars, which, you know, I never, I prefer in my true crime there to be some modicum of justice at the end. So I enjoyed that as well.
Come away satisfied from Homicide New York. 5-part docuseries from Dick Wolf. It's streaming on Netflix. Manhunt is on Apple TV+. It's a dramatic thriller starring Will Harrison and Tobias Menzies and takes us back to the aftermath of the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. Angie.
Yeah, so on the surface, this is a conspiracy thriller about the chase for John Wilkes Booth right after Abraham Lincoln's assassination. It's not a mystery in that, like, you know, everyone even then knows who did it, but it's more of a cat and mouse thing where Tobias Menzies plays the Secretary of War who's kind of leading the charge to find John Wilkes Booth, who is played by Anthony Boyle from Masters of the Air in a very different role. And in that sense, it's really, you know, it's really thrilling. Like I enjoyed kind of the detective-y aspects of it where they're always trying to outmaneuver each other and like follow clues and all that. And it eventually leads to this much grander conspiracy that goes just beyond this one assassin. But beyond that, it also becomes a really interesting drama about the Reconstruction era and just sort of what was lost when Abraham Lincoln died. It becomes a series that's really, you know, curious about the compromises that were made in that time. You know, I think it really takes you back into this headspace where you can kind of see like, oh, okay, this was a nation that was just really like in flux where no one knew what was going to happen. You could see how things could have gone, you know, so much better. You could see how things could have gone so much worse. You see how this nation was in this place where it had all this promise and this potential, and they're trying to figure out where it's going to go. And you also just, and the show is not subtle about also underlining how some of the decisions that were made then kind of to this day our society set up today. So I thought it was a lot of fun, but it was really, really, really thoughtful, often really heartbreaking, not just because the characters are sad, but because you kind of mourn for what could have been a lot of the time. And the actors are just all really good. Like Tobias Menzies, I think he he seems like he was really made for this role. The one thing I will say though, Abraham Lincoln is played by Hamish Linklater with a lot of prosthetics. And I am so over the thing where you pile a lot of prosthetics on an actor to make them look like someone. It always just makes them look weird. But that's kind of my one note. Otherwise, I think it's a really exciting but also really thoughtful series.
Manhunt, 4 of the 7 episodes are out so far. Episode 5 releases tomorrow. There'll be a 7 episode run of Manhunt on Apple TV+. Want to thank our television critics for joining us. Angie Hahn of The Hollywood Reporter and Kristen Baldwin of Entertainment Weekly. Every Thursday, it's Entertainment Thursday on Air Talk, including our TV talk with our TV critics weighing in on the top series, new and returning. I want to thank our tremendous production team. Our senior producer is Matt D'Angelo-Antonio. Our producer, Lindsay Wright, who this week served in the senior capacity. Our thanks to Lucy Kopp, Manny Valladares, Michael Goldsmith. Assisting us this week in production, Daniel Martinez and Peyton Seda. Our apprentice news clerks are Tamar Fagan and Jason Rodriguez, and our terrific technical director and engineer, Evelyn Bocanegra. My thanks to the tremendous team that brings you this program every day, the great guests, all the brainstorming into the segments, and the tremendous dedication that they bring to their job every day. It's an honor to get to work with this team. Here and Now from NPR comes up next. I'll be back with you tomorrow at 10 for Film Week. Led into that at 9 o'clock, Julia Paskin will be guest hosting Air Talk. Have a great rest of the day.